Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. I'm super excited to chat with my guest today. If you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things ideas, innovation, possibility. It's a word that I don't even use that word, but somehow it just came to me in looking at you. Yeah. The you I'm speaking of is Janice Bryant Howroyd. A lot of syllables. Can you say your name?
Yes, I can say my name. I've been saying it for quite a few years. Janice Bryant Howroyd.
Oh, you did so well.
Yeah.
If people have been living under a rock of some sort, or you're at a dinner party and so somebody goes, "Oh, what's a Janice Bryant Howroyd?" Well, how do you explain? What's the one-on-one?
Well, first, let me tell you, this Innovation Crush is really awesome for me because I'm sitting here crushing on Chris. We're having a mom-son, you know, a lot of pride in what you're doing. I think it's just incredible. And it really does preamble quite well into who is Janice Bryant Howroyd. If you'd asked me that question about 3 years ago, I say, I'm the CEO and the founder of Act One Group. We are a workforce solutions organization. We provide talent. We provide technology. We provide process. Today, when you ask me that question, I say, "Hi, I'm JBH. I founded Act One Group. We are the preeminent workforce solutions company across the globe in a lot of areas, and we're growing in others. Right now, I'm really excited, though, because I'm also that chick who's showing up on campuses and working with a lot of millennials and next gens." And so, you see, I've evolved, Chris, since I saw you 2 years ago. Were we in Austin at South by Southwest? Yes.
Yep. Stay weird, Austin, as they say. But
yeah.
And you're not weird at all.
I'm disappointed. You know, I mean, weird is good.
There's all sorts of different kinds of weird. Yeah, so yeah, I don't know who's receiving the information.
Well, maybe we'll go with cute cray, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Cray. Now it's a whole other territory.
You're just laughing.
I know, right? What are we going to talk about? So what prompted that shift? Like what happened at that 3 year mark where you're like, "All right, the conversation is shifting a little bit in how you perceive your place in the world."
You know, I wouldn't even delegate it a shift so much as evolution. I think that I've always been that person I described today. I think I felt the need to cloak my public presence in more of the business and the development of the business. And we've always had elements of why I can describe myself differently today as a part of how we've done business and a part of how I've lived my life.
Right.
I mean, even in our company, we've always said the applicant is the center of the universe. If you talk to anybody from Apple One, that's what they're going to tell you. Now, I see a lot of companies today, Chris, who are speaking in a way that seems revolutionary for them around giving the all bow down to the applicant, to the candidate. But that's been our mantra and that's been our process from day one. So
explain that.
It's been evolving. Yeah. You feel me?
Sure. No. And explain that, the applicant being the center of the universe. Because I think there's a very different perspective than most of us have in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, in my industry where we're oftentimes placing talent with companies one by one, it is the common practice to focus on the client company. They're the ones who get the jelly beans, okay? in our company, we've always believed that if we focus on the applicant, if we get that candidate, and those are interchangeable, if we get that candidate, that right, oftentimes they're interchangeable, if we get that candidate the right position, not just based on their talent, but based on their culture, their personal professional culture, they're going to flourish and do well if they're looking for a full-time career. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're looking for an experience, an opportunity.
Right.
It's going to be more of a program or an initiative that they're working on. And we place them thoughtfully with that in mind, as long as we're focusing on what the client as the applicant need is, then we're going to succeed in a way that the client company can benefit from. And for God's sake, if we're doing it well enough, often enough, then that client can, a company person can buy their own jelly beans.
I love that this is counterintuitive to, again, just the way we think about hiring or those sorts of decisions. Usually, like, we're reverse engineering into some need, right?
Yes,
and especially at the speed by which the world is evolving, you've evolved in the last 3 years, but also, you know, with Act One Group having been around for close to 40 years.
Yes.
And that still being the philosophy that you enter the marketplace with, where technology, like, oh, we need somebody who can do social media. Oh, we need somebody who can code. Or we need somebody who can, you know, spell. Like, whatever.
Right.
How is that still sort of the staple, and how do you get people back to that focal point of the applicant when in that process?
Well, for us, I think that we are having a lot of the applicants being the champions of their own need as well. You see, we've always understood that in some ways we are the agent for the applicant. Mm-hmm. You know how an actor has an agent or an athlete has an agent. We are the agent for the applicant. And so word of mouth has been tremendous about how we operate. And I think that when you look at it from a global perspective and not just a local meaning local to the United States mm-hmm. perspective, then you'll come to understand that there's a great value in it. I'll give you an example of why it's really important to focus on the individual. You are a student of history to some degree, and so you will understand that unions were formed across the world, not just in the USA, when companies weren't taking care of employees the way the employees wanted to be taken care of.
Right.
And while there is a cooperative spirit about how unions and companies work across the globe in some ways, there's also that, you know, kind of discontinent feeling right. that exists as well. Well, when we are the agent for the applicant and we're making sure that we're putting people in the right positions at the right time in the right way, then we are enabling companies and applicants to work in a very fluid and a very, yet a very methodical way to achieve each other's goals. It's so exciting. And you talked about the technology. Sure, our technology does give us a lot of predictive mm-hmm. analytics. It enables us to be very prescribing in how we're working. But at the end of the day, and this is the point I think you're getting to, at the end of the day, there is still that human need that has to be met, and how we do that by focusing on the applicant versus the company, I think has been incredible for the company.
And just to put that in perspective, you know, do you mind listing out a few of your key clients? Because I know there's Delta is a huge one, but like what's that?
Now,
like,
you're saying that, but I do sign contracts with my clients.
Yes.
So I want to be very thoughtful here that and put it this way. If you look at the Fortune 100, mm-hmm. you can pretty much guess that we're doing business with 50 of them. But I do want to make sure that I have the permission of my clients to talk about the relationships we have with them. I think they're bragging about us, and they do that handily.
Right.
You can hardly go to any industry event and find our clients there who aren't bragging about us, though. And I think that's another way to answer your earlier question, that our message is getting out of there. I remember once we had a CEO, and this isn't that long ago, we had a CEO of one of the major utility companies in the nation at a utility industry conference, an energy conference. And she was asked, how are you achieving your diversity goals so handily when the rest of us are struggling? And she looked out to the audience and she said, candidly, because of that company. And she pointed to me as the CEO of the Act One Group. And she said that we had helped her in so many ways, not just by us being a client to them, but we're bringing those diverse suppliers underneath our programs
right.
to her. So she's not losing any of the benefit or any of the innovation that occurs from having multiple providers, but they were all aggregated under our solution. Right. And so it was thrilling for her. And I have to tell you that we were able to assume two other clients just from that one mention. So that's another way it gets that's out great. There. There's a saying, Chris, that you can do well and do good at the same time.
Absolutely.
And I think that we are really living that example right now. And people are wanting to talk about us. We don't invest a lot in advertising our business, you know, and our clients are doing that for us. And whether it's a client company or a client candidate, it's very exciting for me when it happens.
That's really great. Twice you've mentioned the CEO role. I watched an Instagram video you posted recently, and you said, you know, the last time you had been at the Red Cross, you were a clerk.
Yes.
Now you're returning as a CEO.
Yes, you saw that.
I did. I did. I have a very deep research team here. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, like, what happened at that point in time? Like, what were you looking for? Because this all feels very serendipitous how it happened. But what were you looking for at that point in time? And then what found you?
Okay. When I was at the Red Cross, first of all, I was looking for myself. And I think back then we used to say it was actually a day-to-day conversation about finding yourself. Remember, Chris, I'm a hot young chick, but I just got a lot of age, right?
You still got it.
we used to go finding ourselves. And my mom and dad were great in helping me to steer back on track to, you know, mm-hmm. have that happen. And working at the Red Cross was a way for me to explore myself in the nation's capital, to do work in an organization that, from my understanding, was out there helping people in critical need situations. I remember, Chris, that I worked in the Armed Forces Reporting Unit, and we did very valuable work because we were connecting families with Armed Forces members. We were connecting not just products and goods in disaster periods, but also service and connectivity for people. And so it felt really wholesome toward what I wanted to be doing.
Right.
And I actually at that time thought that I would career up in the Red Cross.
So then the transition happened, though.
Right? I went on vacation.
It never came back.
I'm still on vacation, Chris. Still on vacation, yeah.
Decades later, you're like, I forgot I was supposed to be back there, you guys. So you went on vacation, and then, yes, you were at Billboard because of your brother-in-law.
Tommy Noonan, God bless
Tommy
him.
Tommy Noonan.
Shout out.
I was going to raise a roof, but nobody would see me do it.
Uh-huh.
And
my sister Sandy.
But here's what I like about what you did at that point in time. You did something you didn't necessarily have permission to do.
Yeah, I was acting up.
Right. Mm-hmm, And so where did that come from? Is it because of the large family? I'm gonna just change this. Like nobody.
Look, when you're number four in a family of 11 children, you do learn to raise your voice a little bit, right? Whether you do that literally or figuratively. I will say though that all kudos to mom and dad, mm-hmm. because I've said it many times: 11 kids, one mom, one dad, and each of us have felt, you know, spoiled in some degree as an only child. To answer your question directly, I remember that back in the day, we used to go to church a lot. And at Easter time, we'd all say Easter speeches. And I had the longest Easter speech of anybody in my in my class. I'm saying.
You don't say.
Right? And I had it down and I did it well mm-hmm. at home. And it was time to do it on Sunday morning. And I kind of froze. And Mommy, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And I remember my mom pushing me out onto the quote unquote stage at the church. And she said, Janice Elretha, she said, in order to be outstanding, sometimes you're going to have to stand out. Get out there. Mm. And I've always had this concept of team player. I share with employees at one of our conferences a couple of years ago, and I saw faces of surprise when I said, you know, I've lived my life for so many years as a Bryant. I never knew how to be a Janice until recently. our family was so tight and so supportive of each other. And everything we did was around the team concept that it took me being an adult and very late in my career. I was a CEO in my career before I actually found Janice. I was very happy, very motivated, and very comfortable being a Bryant, even as a married woman with Howroyd on my name. My husband loves to say, you know, you always say the Bryant louder than the Howroyd when you give your name. So, you know, that branding, that identity that I have as a member of a family has been very strong for me. And it's only recently that I have started to explore the Janice in it.
But a little bit of reverse engineering. How does the family aspect or approach to the things you do and how you see yourself play out in how you operate a business?
Well, there are so many, and two of them to share with you are, number one, I have a lot of family in my business, and they have been critical to my ability to grow my business. Now, there are a lot of family members in the Act One group who are
literal family members.
DNA family members, because our family, there are people who've been in the Act One group who've worked for 30 and 40 of those years you talk about, who are as intimately engaged in the success of Act One, whether it's Apple One, Agile One, HEC, the various brands underneath the Act One group. These people love this organization, and we love them. And we celebrate, you know, births and marriages and children and buying homes together. So, you know, I can't talk about family without talking about the people in the company who are making that up. My chief of staff has been with us under very many different scenarios in the growth of our company. He is definitely family. David, the people my mom and dad gave birth to are also critical to who the company is. And they've been there from day one, whether they've been there as employees or whether they've been there as family members helping employees. And they have an etiquette, and they have a protocol that is very understanding of where their role is in a company where every individual needs to see they have an opportunity to grow, and they see no barriers to their growth. And so family members don't stand in the way of people's growth, but they've definitely been the platform for so much of the growth of the company. And I couldn't sit here and talk with you today were it not for the support of many of my DNA family members who came into the organization and not just helped me at critical times, but have oftentimes offer some of the best innovation we have.
That's awesome. When I hear that, I also think of just about the...
And people don't think that a lot about Black families either, you know. I mean, this isn't the subject of your...
famous... No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but I mean, and I got to give my mom and dad kudos on this, Chris. Yeah. You know, now 3 years ago, I wouldn't have said this. Today, I'm saying this. I'm giving my mom and dad kudos because I'm talking about a family who bring a lot of support, work together, and you don't have dirty drama behind it.
Yeah.
You know, and so well, that's a blessing that I got to shout out
that's
about.
That's the other thing. Like, when it's such a large family, like, I had a chance to email him, but I also interviewed Miguel McKelvey, the founder of WeWork. And one of the things we talked about
Organization.
Yeah, awesome organization. And, you know, speaking of DNA or just how your personal DNA goes into the company, you know, he grew up in sort of a communal style living, right? Like his mom and her couple friends, and there was like five or six kids between them. They shared resources and rides and clothes and food. And that's very
just
much
like my
ethos,
DNA family
right?
did.
It's the ethos of what WeWork is, right? And so this focus.
You go there,
the
you
upgrade.
See that. It's evident there.
Yeah. So when did you know this? And just for the sake of the audience, when I talked about you breaking the rules earlier, that was sort of like your brother-in-law went on vacation. You sort of retooled some things as a temp yourself. But when did you know that you were on to something? Like, what was that first sign of success or significance in what you were doing?
So key, and you're so on point, Chris. My brother-in-law knew before I did, but for me to know it, was late after I'd actually started my company. Because when I started my company, I didn't start my company with visions of being the, you know, significant workforce solutions organization in an industry. I couldn't have even worded that when I started my company. I was just placing people. Okay. I was giving people an experience I'd not found for myself in the process of job search. But I knew I was onto something when I was sitting in my office on Hawthorne Boulevard in Torrance, and my sister Sandy was helping me, and she said, oh, listen, had it not been Sandy, I wouldn't have believed it. She said, Gwen Moore wants to speak with you. I said, what do you mean Gwen Moore wants to speak with me? Now, for little black girls, Gwen Moore was a shero simply because she was an elected congresswoman in the state of California. For business people, Gwen Moore is a shero because she wrote and led the legislated effort to have an inclusive supply chain in utility companies. She said ratepayers should be represented in your procurement. And so I knew her from those two areas, and I couldn't believe that this important person wanted to talk with me. So I handily said yes. When I did talk with Gwen Moore, she came in fussing, you know, hand on your hip, head wagging,
she
fussing. She
was acting up.
She was acting up. And she said, Janice, I've seen you out here and I've supported your effort and I admire your company, but you need to do something. And I said, excuse me, you need to go get yourself certified. Now, I'm from the great state of North Carolina. So, you know, when you certify, we certify beef. Okay. You know, and I'm
that's
like,
what we do in Tarsboro.
Is right. Tarboro. Yeah. But anyway, Chris, the bottom line is Gwen led me toward a different direction than I had thought I should go. I was doing very well, thank you, as around a $10 million company, highly profitable, placing people, mostly full-time placement. And I wasn't really interested in hearing what Gwen had to say at first. She sat down, and in short of 20 minutes, she had me in tears, understanding the value, the need, and the criticality of getting my company certified to do business as a woman-owned and a minority-owned company that I'd never broached before. I honestly thought, if I'm good enough, I'm going to get the business I want, and I'm going to grow, and I'm doing very well. And she helped me to understand it's not just for you. We talked earlier about doing well and doing good at the same time. She said, even if you didn't want to expand your business around certified areas of opportunity, you'd need to do it for the other companies who've not reached scale that you have, and to be able to be leading and guiding for them. And there's not one instance anywhere in the more than 22 countries we service across this globe that I do business with a supplier that we add one. And I don't think about that day Gwen Moore walked into my office and told me off.
And is that the first time you felt a responsibility? I mean, you know, a lot of times when you Google, when I Google your name, or when one does, you know, there's a lot of first black woman, .. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I feel like sometimes there's like, I just want to be Janice. And then there's times where I was like, okay, now I'm this trail. Like, I need to carry the shovel.
Yeah.
Like,
how
do you balance that out if that's true?
And the answer to the first part of your question is that the first time, no, I grew up in a service mentality home. So we saw service as the work of God. And that has continued to be thematic for me as I've lived my life. What Gwen did was she showed me how changing the instrument of my business was of a great service as well, not just the charitable service that I offered as a benefit or an outcome from the business I was doing. She really changed my mind on how I was thinking there. And I think that kind of gets to the point of the question you're asking.
And even along those lines, I mean, you've continued that. I mean, as your business has grown, as you've grown as a personal brand and, you know, just expanded your reach, you've worked with and alongside presidents and the FCC, and every organization probably has a JBH like in it, on its website somewhere. Why continue to expand, especially in those, let's call it the upper echelon of, you know, your own brand presence and power in that arena?
Some of the best relationships I have on a personal level. Let's understand that we walk in about the business and that has to happen. But some of the best relationships, some of the people who I call that non-DNA family, those, you know, and girlfriends and guy friends have occurred for me through organizations like WeBank. Pam Easton is running WeBank in a way that is so dynamic around celebrating not just the opportunity for women to grow their businesses, but she opens it up to new and innovative thought that her members can bring. I remember just short of maybe 3 years ago, I was sitting in a meeting and we were discussing at the board level what next we need to do in WeBank. And everybody rallied around the idea that we've got to take care of the next generation. Now we have a next gen organization that I sponsor within WeBank. I'm one of the sponsors of. And it's such an exciting thing that we're doing. We're going to be having an event in North Carolina coming up. And those kids are going to be running around in t-shirts with, you know, my logo on their mm-hmm. on their shoulder. And it's all about supporting STEM, you know, for women. Right. And so when you talk about why continue to do this and why continue to engage, that's one example of many. NMSDC, National Minority Supplier Development Council, incredible work. One of the first organizations I ever joined and became a Corporate Plus member. And that was way back in the day when a woman named Harriet Michelle was leading NMSDC, and Ray Jensen, a Ford Motor Company, was investing not just time and attention, but dollars from Ford to support that minority firms got right. opportunities in companies. Women president owners, Marsha Firestone out of New York. She works incredibly successful for supporting women, and she is affiliated with WeBank. So there's the connection there.
So we're going to ask you, because I know mm-hmm. you can keep listening for the next 45 minutes.
I mean, yeah. But we connect. NGLCC, you know? National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce.
How easy is it for you, and is it just part of like who you are, to connect those dots, right? I feel like a lot of people are well-resourced, but not everybody has the ability to connect the dots when it's time to connect them. How does that operate for you?
I think because I come from the head and lead from the heart, you know, and that is not something that I discovered. I think it is something that mom and dad really exampled for us mm-hmm. as we were growing up. These organizations, I have to say, in and of themselves right now in their current iteration are led by some incredible people as well. So these are people you want to know. You know, Justin at NGLCC is somebody you want to know. You want to know him right. because he's a great guy, you mm-hmm. know. And then you get into the work of what that organization is doing. And I will tell you, I look at where, to go back to my core work, where mm-hmm. talent, where the workers of today are, who want to be able to enjoy their careers, whether they're going to do that as an employee or whether they're going to do that as an independent contractor, whether they're going to do that as a customer to a company. We can work with them in all of those ways. We don't just find individual talent. But the thematic commonality I see amongst all of them is that they want to be associated with companies who are investing in things and opportunities and initiatives that they truly care about. And so the organizations I'm talking with you, in many ways, are corporations' best friends as well. You know, they are making sure that we're doing things in a way that enable full communities right. to thrive. And, I know you're about the community and I'm about the community, and the community by definition is very different than when I started my Absolutely. Company years ago. If you ask many of, you can ask my own kids to describe what their community looks like, and they're going to give you a much broader and a much more thoughtful answer than had you asked either of us that 40 years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, and many of us live in more than one community.
Yes. Well, and that's all. I mean, there's so much to unpack with you. So you mentioned sort of these different touch points and what communities look like, what employees are expecting, what companies are expecting from employees. There was a quote you said, and I was looking for it in my notes, and I write too sloppy, so I'm going to botch it. But it was something along the lines of, like, if you're not a data-driven organization, you're not an organization.
You're not in business, right?
The data points have also shifted.
Yeah.
So what, you know, what sorts of new data are you looking at, especially when it comes to like qualitative, you know, like emotional intelligence kind of data, which I don't think we looked at, you know, 10 years ago, really, you know, and let alone when you first started the business.
And you want to be very thoughtful, Chris, about how you use data as well, because, you know, every coin has four sides and two of those can be a positive or a negative. And when you think about data, predictive analytics are very helpful to companies and they can help plan in ways that, you know, never before they were able to. However, you want to make sure that you're very thoughtful about how you're engaging that when you're talking about people because of two things. Number one, you want to respect people's rights. So how far, how deep do you go into it as an employer? Okay. And then the second thing is people are always changing and shifting. So I can give very definitive information about how you're going to respond or how you're going to proact based on where you are right now.
Right.
You can walk out this door, have an experience, and all of that data is for nil because now you have changed. So yes, we have to be very thoughtful when we're integrating data and other advantages of technology into our thought process. We're never going to get away from being human is the point I'm making.
Well, and there's also like gut is a big part of decision-making processes, right? Like despite what the data shows, I mean, inventive spirits have gone against the grain since the dawn of time.
How often have you in your young life said, wow, I surprised myself or why did I do that? Yeah. You know, that's a data shift for you. That's a data shift for you.
You get what
absolutely. I'm saying. So.
Every time I think of the title of the book, I go, act up, you can get smacked up.
Right?
Like, I think you should do a deal with the city girl. Okay, that's
all. Okay, all right. Okay, let's talk about that.
So, no, I mean, all this wisdom is kind of poured into, you know, a couple hundred pages.
I actually did think, though, Chris, for a brief moment, that a lot of what I look to share, if I could sit down and I could work with an artist to actually put that into song, it could be very, you know, when we look at when good revolutions have occurred from a societal or an economic perspective, they've all come on the wings of song, right? Bob Dylan wrote songs.
On the wings Beatles of love.
Them. Yeah.
Yes, only the two of us.
Right, you got to sing that one because you can't sing the I believe I can fly anymore. That ain't allowed anymore.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, no,
you know, but you get, or We Shall Overcome, or, yes, you know, and think about the 60s, all the songs, you know, around movement, the movement songs, the great movement songs. But I did think that we don't need to have a movement to have great songs. I did actually think about sitting down with an artist and just writing songs that help with people with their own experiences, because you never can have too many love songs, but actually having those love songs go in a deeper and a more definitive direction around how people lift themselves up and just the great society movement.
No, absolutely. I was going to say, I'm going to do a little bit of humble brag. So for my book, because it was kind of rooted in a lot of the interviews I'd done, I reached out to those people and asked them who their favorite artist or album was.
Yeah.
And we put together a mixtape with a good friend of mine, Mick, who's a super well-known.
You didn't ask me. Yeah.
You weren't on the, you hadn't been on the show yet.
Yeah.
It was, this has been a long time coming.
So who gave mine? Who gave my answer?
No, I don't have your answer yet.
I'm telling you my answer.
What is it?
Well, a lot of people say Inner Visions, Stevie Wonder, but I got to lean back to Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. When you listen to those songs and you listen to Today, they layer on top of each other as if he wrote it last night.
It's such a, I mean, this is a tangent, but it's just, to me, it speaks about how history repeats itself.
Absolutely.
You know, and maybe here's what I'll do, because I'm a good interviewer. What cycles have you seen leave and come back in the, you know, the time that Act One Group has been around? In terms,
you mean
of
other than my shoes?
Well, no,
you're laughing.
We're
because
gonna get a picture
today. Actually, you're on point there because you know I'll go into rooms. I was at Morehouse 2 or 3 days ago, and I walked into a room, and young girls will walk up, and young men, and as a matter of fact, I gotta correct myself. I was at Federal Reserve speaking from stage. And, you know, these are bankers, right?
Yeah.
And this one man, he looked to be somewhere between 35 and 55 and white guy. And he asked his question and question answered. And then he told me, and you look, I forget his exact words. You look, what were his exact words? You look so awesome.
Right.
You know, and he was like going on about my outfit, and I was wearing animal print. I was really wearing it. It wasn't wearing me, right?
I saw that. Actually, I saw pictures of that.
Yeah. He went off. He went off like how incredible I look, you know. But my point is, aside from clothes, clothes say a lot about where the world is at any moment as well. You know, we wore big shoulder pads during the Second World War, and women were out lifting and hauling with big shoulders like men did. And the clothing reflected that. And in the 60s, where we wanted to let it all hang out, we did. Mm-hmm. We took the bras off and lifted the hemline. So I'm not being frivolous here to say the clothes indicate the change. When I look in my wardrobe, because I gift a lot of stuff, but I keep a lot too, I can see the changes in the economy. I can see the changes in society by reflecting on what's in my closet as well. Yeah. It really is a big help to me. And some of the
an interesting vantage point, right? I mean, especially, I think, you know, you are a visual brand as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that going along with that journey and being able, it's like looking at, I was looking through old photos recently and it just took me back to like what was happening culturally at that time. And also, you know, again, from a business perspective, how you survive those changes and shifts and
survive to thrive.
Right.
Don't simply survive to live, right. Survive to thrive.
Yes.
You know, and I say that dynamically because for women, for minorities, for which includes gays, a lot of us were surviving to live.
Yes.
You know, we just wanted to live and leave us our little space. And today, what's so exciting for me is we're also having a louder voice and saying, we're not just going to live here. We're going to thrive here. Mm-hmm. We contribute to it and we want to benefit and enjoy it out loud with you, you know, and that's what's exciting and different. That's the big difference today.
Well, speaking of surviving and thriving, there's a story in your book where you talk about there was a teacher and it was a history lesson. And he said, Black people are perfect to be slaves. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Yeah.
And he got up on a desk and did it. You were the only Black kid in that class.
Yep.
And you wanted to go home and your dad gave you some great advice. But I think that my interpretation of that was also the amount of grit it takes to thrive, which is a great word you use, right? Because we can all survive. But to thrive and do well despite all the other inputs that happen around you. Do you think part of your success is rooted in incidents like that, you know, or is it just kind of like where's that grit come from where you're like, all right, I see what you did. Let's keep it moving.
So years ago, I was being honored along with Cicely Tyson and what was Miss Jefferson's name? Louise Jefferson's name. And
George.
Yeah.
And that's the only impression you'll get.
And Lawrence Fishburne. And I was like, how did I end up on this stage? I've asked myself that so many times in my career. How did I end up on this stage? Mm-hmm. Right. But I was being honored for the work that I had done. And I remember one of the questions the interviewer asked was, did all of the hardships and the, in that instance, racism you face, impact you and help you to be where you are now? And the great Cicely Tyson did speak eloquently to how it had done such. But when they asked Louise Jefferson, please help me to give her a real name.
Let's get a Google search going.
Please. She answered, I didn't need the interference of racists to help me to be where I am today. My mother and father did a great job of elevating my consciousness. I would say my answer would echo hers. I have not needed the prejudices and the difficulties along my journey to elevate my ability nor my spirit right now to be where I am. Mom and Dad did a great job of that.
Because I know your dad in this specific instance did a great job because he said, no one has the right to force you to decide how you feel about you.
Absolutely, Dad said that. And much later, when I was in California visiting my sister, before I even thought about starting a company, I was just trying to figure out how to start myself day to day. I came to California and I didn't look really pretty like all the women I was meeting, and all the Black women I were meeting, for some reason, they were all light skinned with flow hair. And here I am, dark skinned with the nappy hair.
Well, they were styling
natives. And well, yeah, you know, now I'm really hot and right. I can go natural and it can work.
It's all cyclical.
I wasn't the fad at that point. But I remember I was dealing with that. And my sister told me, you know, Jan, the space between your two ears is the most expensive real estate you'll ever own. Mm. Don't let people live there rent free. So she iteratively was giving me the same lesson my dad had given me all those years before. And I think that as human creatures, we do sometimes have to be, you know, we have to revisit the lessons that we've learned well. But the gift she gave me was the gift Dad gave all of us. Dad thought he had truly, and Mom had given birth to the brightest, most beautiful people on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And he always told us that. And Mom always reminded us that pretty is as pretty does, and that all of that comes with an obligation to be of service and to be thoughtful. Never elevate yourself above someone else. You can learn from everybody. And those are the kinds of things that we left the nest understanding. And in the flight of life, sometimes we have to go back to the nest.
Yeah.
And revisit and, you know, refuel.
Your children have had a very different experience growing up. And there's a quote that I love that says, sometimes we try so hard to give our kids what we didn't have that we forget to give them what we did have.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you go about child rearing?
Well, the truth is that African proverb that Hillary made popular here later, mm-hmm. it takes a village to raise a child. My family is that core village, mm-hmm. and our kids have always been very present to where I grew up and how I grew up. Chris, it would be great to sit here and tell you I did that by strategy. I didn't. My family, you just, they're in your mm-hmm. face, mm-hmm. you know? And we see each other. We're very clannish. We love each other. And if somebody's not visiting Tarboro, then somebody's visiting California. And so there's always been that community of where my kids have been raised. And my kids go back to Tarboro, North Carolina, and they see the Tarboro I grew up in. They saw it for many years before the flood because it didn't change that
right.
much. And so they do know that. And because of the work I do on committee and in organizations, they've always been present with me to that. They know they are blessed, mm-hmm. and they know that to whom much is given, much is required. They've grown up understanding that. It would be great to be able to say, I designed it as such.
Mm-hmm.
I did not. The community I live in made it such.
They prevented them from acting up.
Yeah.
So I have so much I want to get to, but we only have so much time in a day. We have to do this in
change
two parts.
The day.
Change the day. Yeah, there you go. Not seize the day.
Mm-hmm,
change
the day. Mm-hmm.
So as you know, I've been on the board of an all-girls STEM school for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But you also recently started a STEM practice within Act One Group. Why and how did that come to be?
You might say that all STEM is the thing that I've been working toward all my career, whether I knew it or not. All STEM is engaging talent with companies in a way that supports women and minorities dynamically. And I am so excited about it. Peter Cavaglio, who led my Agile One group for years, and I had several conversations before we determined that, now is the moment. This is the moment. And so he's now leading all STEM for me. And the work that we are doing is so incredible. We've formed a partnership with an organization called OHUB.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Are you familiar? Rodney Sampson.
Yeah.
I was just with Rodney over at Morehouse's campus when I mentioned being on Morehouse. That was part of my book tour.
You know what's really funny? So when I launched my book last year, that was the very first time I spoke about it, was at OHUB at South by Southwest.
And yeah.
Literally, like, I had an event booked later that day, but I stopped by OHUB because all those college kids that were there as part of their group was like, it was amazing. I stayed there for like 4 hours.
Oh my God.
I was hanging out.
And that felt short. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was amazing. So yeah, shout out to Rodney. So, but yes.
Yeah. And so working with people like Rodney is the direction I'm going. You know, we're going a little bit more gritty in terms of how we're doing this. And companies are really appreciating it, you know. For years, companies look for people who look like them. Mm-hmm. Now they want people who can help them to reinvent how they look. And so when you're working with organizations like OHUB, you're not going to miss, you know. It's just so incredible for me to have All STEM up and running and doing so well. All STEM thrived within 30 days of opening. That's historical.
What? That's crazy.
That's historical.
Define thrive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, All STEM customer engagement, applicant availability, and matching those two to profit within 30 days.
Wow.
How incredible is that?
Let's just hang out with you for 30
days. I mean, you can't even sell cupcakes that quickly,
You see me trying to sell stuff.
Yeah.
So the show's called Innovation Crush, as you well know. You've seen a lot, and we've talked about a lot. What do you see out in the world that you personally have an innovation crush on?
Oh, geez. I think it's the next gen, the newer generation is who I'm crushing on. And I say that collectively versus a technology or versus a movement, because I think that the way they're thinking and the way they're not thinking, there's so much opportunity to still jump in and help that to framework for who we are. As let me give you an example of why I say this. Been interned in our company for a year. Ben is going back as a senior at university to a school in Middle England. Mm-hmm. And you've got
not Middle
this,
Earth. Huh? Not Middle Earth.
That's, No. I'm not calling his school out because I'm respecting Ben's anonymity.
Right.
But Ben was a student. Ben worked in our company for a year as part of his exchange. And just before he was about to go back to England, I sat down with this 6'2" redheaded, blue-eyed fellow and asked him about his experience. And he described how awesome it had been, what he'd learned, and, you know, possibilities. You used the word possibility earlier, possibilities that he saw. And our conversation continued, and we got to a point where Ben was describing how, but he just didn't know if it was worth all of it. And I asked him why, because he was a very positive kind of, you know, party on the weekend guy. Mm-hmm. And he's described to me the world as he saw it. I saw Ben as going out as, you know, a champion in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And he described the world, Chris, and he was saying he didn't know if it was worth it because he asked me, did I realize that the map of Europe had changed more in his lifetime than it had 100 years before? He asked me if I had stopped to notice that when you walk into restaurants in much of England, you see signs on them that brag that they don't buy meat from America. He asked me, and wow. Are you getting where I'm
sure,
going?
Sure, yeah.
The environment.
The perspective, like just the things that, I think there's a lot more attention of things that we just never paid attention
to. The fact that
it matters, right?
Yeah, the fact that he could go into a mall and on point, Ben said this, not me. He said, you know, on point, you can have 10, 20 malls blown up at the same time across the world and take out people that way. So Ben's concerns, even beyond the excitement of working in a corporate office in America to take that experience back to his business school, his excitement was being challenged by his concern about planet Earth and about the geopolitical environment that he will be working citizen in. Brexit changed his ideas. He started university thinking about one career path, and Brexit changed out. And regardless of which side of the argument you're on around Brexit or, you know, any
the
political
tension
thing,
of it alone,
he's a young person.
Right.
whose career is being defined differently than even a young person like you, your career was. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
No, 100%. I would love to see somebody do sort of a neuroscience study, like on the collective and consciousness.
That is around, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know.
The emotional intelligence, the inputs are
that's
very
where my innovation
different.
Crush is.
That's amazing.
That's yeah. where my innovation crush you know what my is. Innovation crush is let's talk with, yeah, what is it? I don't know.
Isabel Sanford.
Oh, Isabel Sanford is Louise Jefferson's name. Yes, we had to do that. Yes. We had to give kudos to her. And you know, the first apartment I ever had was in Park La Brea. And she was a resident there, so I would see her, and I just loved her stature. But when I heard her answer on that award night, it really blew my mind. I was like, yeah, you go, Isabel.
I wonder if Wanda Sykes one day will have the same answer, because she was in the Jefferson's Live.
Yeah.
Last but not least, complete this phrase for me.
Okay.
Innovation to me is?
Everything.
Continue.
Growing up in a community and in a home where religion and faith lived side by side, I knew that the argument around evolution, creation, and humanity was something that I would need to understand in order to prevail.
Yeah.
In my own way. And as I have experienced so much change in how I live and do work, and so much non-change in how I live and do life, it's been really important to me to respect that at the end of the day, innovation is what is new in this moment. But in terms of whole life, nothing is ever new. We just experience it for the first time.
And the book is called Acting Up. That was extremely eloquent, more eloquent than your usual. So where can people find the book? Is it just going out? Like, is it everywhere? Where?
I want people to go either to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Or to Walmart online to get the book. And more importantly, I want people to get the book, read it, and leave a positive review on Amazon.
Very important. And I want somebody to turn the book into a movie. It's pretty
you know what? Somebody else asked me that. Yeah. Somebody, as a matter of fact, I had an actress. I don't have her permission to use her name, but she's enjoying a really hot career right now.
What does it rhyme with?
And I saw her.
No rhyme. Oh, facet.
Facet. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if you guys heard the whisper
fabulous,
there, but that was
fabulous, beautiful lady, right? from my home state of North Carolina. So do your homework. Anyway, she had asked me several years ago. We were on a dais together, and she said, "Oh, I want to do your life. I want to do your life in a movie." I don't know if she'll remember asking me this, but I kind of think she will, because she's not a frivolous person, and she's actually gone on to produce as well as to act. I thought about her recently because I've had so many other people come up. Now, she asked me early on, and then I've had so many other people come up and ask about doing the movie of my life. And I say, well, you know, I'm not done yet. That's you true. Know, you want a good ending? Wait, it ain't happened yet.
It can be a trilogy. Thank you for
Love
coming
your
by.
Thinking.
And thank you for wearing an amazing outfit. He probably said it's fire. That's probably what he said. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.